This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
It was the biggest refugee camp in Europe. Overnight, fire burned the camp in Greece to the ground. 12,000 people fled for their lives.
Many people are homeless now. They have no shelter, they have no clothes, they have no food from last night until now.
I'm Marco Werman, also today on The World. For the first time, the Afghan government and the Taliban are about to sit down for face-to-face peace talks.
Our universal values of human rights, women's rights, minorities, and freedom, all of them are at stake.
And South Africa's female track sensation is told she must take hormone blockers to compete in the Olympics. Her lawyer says,
never. She won't do it. Period. That's it. Never.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us. Fires in a lot of places today, in Washington State, California, and also in Greece on the island of Lesbos, where we begin the show today. Until last night, the island had been home to the largest refugee camp in Europe. But overnight, that camp was destroyed by fire. The World's Lydia Emanalidou is on the Greek mainland. Lydia, what is the latest?
So, Marco, the latest is, as you said, that Moria, the camp, is now burned to the ground. Moria is a former military base that, during the height of the migrant crisis in 2015, when thousands of migrants started arriving from, neighboring Turkey, was transformed into a camp. And it's meant for about 3,000 people, but about 12,000 were living there inside the camp and in surrounding areas. I should say about 40% of those people are children, and all of them had to flee overnight. So I've been speaking with migrants, refugees, and NGOs on the ground on Lesbos. Doug Herman runs an NGO called Refocus Media Labs, which trains refugees on how to become journalists and tell their own stories. He's on Lesbos, and he told me that last night, overnight on Wednesday, several fires started around the camp.
And those eventually spread into the camp, and they kind of just rip through the structures.
These structures, Marco, that Herman is talking about, and I saw them myself when I was there back in March, they're made of wood, cloth, bags, sheets, whatever the migrants can kind of piece together. And these are highly flammable structures.
And those thousands of people who had to flee, where are they now?
So for now, Greek police have set up blockades to limit where the migrants and refugees can go. Earlier, I spoke with Aziz, a 23-year-old migrant from Afghanistan. And by the way, we're only using his first name because he has concerns about his safety and his status.
Many people are homeless now. Many people are in the streets, and they have no shelter, they have no clothes, they have no food now from last night until now.
And Margo, the Greek government says that officially, of the 12,000 people that were living in the camp and around the camp, that 3,500 of them are now homeless.
Lydia, what do we know about how this fire started?
Earlier today, Greek Migration Minister Notis Mitarakis, during a press conference, said that the fire was started by camp residents that were unhappy with the COVID-related lockdown measures that the Greek government implemented recently. So for the past 6 months or so, there have been strict lockdown measures. And since last week, when the first positive COVID case was detected inside the camp, the Greek government has implemented even stricter measures. And so the Greek government claims that the fires were started by migrants who were unhappy with those measures. Others say that it was local Greeks who were frustrated by the ongoing situation. But we haven't been able to independently confirm either of those stories. But the Greek government claims this wasn't an accident.
So what happens to all these people who've been displaced from Moria? Will they be getting help, and from whom?
Yeah, so according to the Greek migration minister, 400 unaccompanied minors are currently being transferred to the mainland. He also said that about 1,000 migrants and refugees will be temporarily housed on boats, and that the Navy is sending ships to provide additional accommodations. Another thing, as I mentioned, is that we heard about the first confirmed case of COVID inside the camp last week. Since then, that number has risen to about 35, and those 35 migrants and refugees who tested positive were being held in a separate location. The government says that they've only been able to locate about 8 of them since the fire broke out.
Yeah, pile up of multiple calamities on Lesbos. It's not a good situation. The World's Lydia Manolidou, based in Athens. Thanks for the latest on this fire, Lydia.
Thanks, Marco.
A car bomb targeting Afghanistan's vice president killed at least 10 people in Kabul today and injured more. Vice President Amrullah Saleh survived with burns to his hands. It was the latest in a series of high-profile attacks in Afghanistan. The timing is significant because after months of delay, Afghan government officials are finally getting ready for their first face-to-face peace talks with the Taliban. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
The vice president appeared on a video shortly after the attack today, his left hand covered in bandages and looking shaken. Saleh said the force from the blast was so strong it melted the window of his car. The attack comes just as the Afghan government gets ready to meet with its longtime enemy, the Taliban, for the first time. Last February, the Trump administration signed an agreement with the Taliban.
We've had tremendous success in Afghanistan in the killing of terrorists, but it's time, after all these years, to go and to bring our people back home.
The agreement came with a series of promises, among them that the Afghan government would release 5,000 Taliban prisoners, and in exchange, the Taliban would release 1,000 prisoners it was holding. The Afghan government was not part of the talks that reached the agreement and seemed to be caught off guard with the announcement. At first, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani denied there was any prisoner release in the works, but several months later, the prisoner swap took place. Afghans who've lost loved ones to Taliban violence are outraged. Yasser Qobadian was 2 years old when the group killed his father. A few years later, they killed his sister in another attack. You released 5,000 Taliban prisoners, he told Afghan officials on national TV this week. But you never asked me about it. What about justice for my family, he asked. Officials have presented the swap as a sacrifice that Afghans had to make. Yasser Qobadian doesn't see it that way. Peace without justice doesn't make sense to me, he said. And there's something else that frustrates him. France, Australia, and Norway opposed the release of a handful of high-profile Taliban prisoners convicted of killing their citizens. In those cases, the Afghan government negotiated an alternative. The vice president said 6 prisoners will be sent to Qatar, the Persian Gulf country where Taliban has an office. He said there will be restrictions on their passports and they won't be able to come back to Afghanistan. But the decision left Qobadian and other survivors wondering why their government listened to foreigners but not them. Are we not your people? Qobadian asked on TV. At least 3 prisoners in the group are accused of killing American troops. But the Trump administration wants the peace negotiations to move ahead. The president wants to bring down the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan by half before the November election. Narges Nihan is a former Afghan minister of mining. She worries that the White House is too eager to cut a deal.
Our universal values of human rights, women's rights, minorities, liberty, and freedom, all of them are at stake.
Nihan spoke recently on a Zoom panel set up by the Georgetown Institute for Women, Peace and Security. She said Afghan women especially are concerned about the outcome of these talks. She said they don't want to see their country slide back into the dark days of Taliban rule, when women were treated as second-class citizens.
Right now, a number of Afghan women leaders are receiving training on their Islamic rights, that how we can reason with the Taliban.
There are a few women on the negotiating team. Fawzia Koofi, a prominent Afghan politician, is one of them. She's been pushing for women's rights for years. That puts her at risk. Last month, she survived an assassination attempt. Another politician, Zarifa Ghaffari, tells me she has been targeted too.
My life is kind of stuck between home and office. I can't go anywhere. I can't run anywhere. I can't walk anywhere.
Ghaffari is the 27-year-old mayor of a province near Kabul. Back in March, the U.S. State Department recognized her work with the International Women of Courage Award.
At the same time, I was receiving threats from Taliban by WhatsApp, by Twitter.
She says she shared the messages with Afghan security forces.
I was really scared and I told them that I'm already targeted, but after this award, this is going to be worse.
Just days after Ghaffari returned to Afghanistan, gunmen attacked her car. She survived but was shaken. Like others, Ghaffari is concerned about what a deal with the Taliban would mean for her country. She wants the bloodshed to end, but wonders how much more Afghans will have to pay for a promise of peace. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Drug company AstraZeneca and researchers at Oxford University have hit pause on the trial of their coronavirus vaccine. Regulators say they're reviewing safety data after a potentially unexplained illness of a participant. The vaccine is in phase 3 trials. It's being tested on thousands of participants in Brazil, South Africa, the U.S., India, and the U.K. Professor Shabir Mahdi, who's leading the trial in South Africa, says the pause demonstrates the rigor of the independent oversight process.
Assessing the safety of the vaccine is the reason why studies such as these are essential in South Africa before there is widespread use of the vaccine.
Here to explain what all of this means is Ian Jones. He's a professor of virology at the University of Reading in the UK. Why put the trial of this vaccine on pause? Can you explain that?
Well, it's probably true that the symptoms that the individual is experiencing could be plausibly related to the vaccine itself. I mean, clearly, when you trial anything in a large population, up to 30,000 people overall in this case, you're likely to encounter situations where the individual is suffering from something purely as a coincidence at the same time as they are participating in the trial. However, if these symptoms that they show are something which could be related to the vaccine, then I think it's correct that the trial is halted until there's a full investigation of the symptoms in that individual.
Ian, what typically happens during a pause in trials and what has to happen before the trial starts again?
Well, the giving out of the vaccine and the placebo will now be halted, and there'll be a thorough investigation of the case history of the individual who's reporting the symptoms. In particular, they will be looking for whether or not there's any indication of a co-infection with something else, which could explain the symptoms and rule out any direct causal effect of the vaccine. If that data looks satisfactory, I would think that the trial would resume fairly quickly, given the urgency, probably within about a week.
Oh, so in terms of a setback and getting the vaccine out into the world, does this represent a major problem?
I would say not. I would say all of the data to date for this vaccine, and of course it's not the only vaccine, there are many programs out there, many of them quite similar actually to the Oxford vaccine. They've all suggested only minor adverse effects and relatively good immunity data. So I don't think this is a major stop-go finding at the present time, but it would be nice to get to the bottom of it and know perhaps if there's a small population of individuals for whom the vaccine is not advised.
Ian, how worried are you that this whole process is being rushed? And are you assured this week that 9 companies put out this joint statement that they stand with science and would not put out a vaccine under political pressure, for example, until it had been thoroughly vetted for safety and efficacy?
Yes, I stand by that. I think this is an unprecedented situation, and it's really pushing all the levers to try to get vaccines developed as fast as possible so that they can have a prophylactic effect. And you've got to set that also against the fact that vaccination has been one of the major themes in healthcare, which has given us the longevity that we enjoy today. So it's easy at a time when there is very little risk around to criticize vaccines. But the fact of the matter is, they're extremely important. They have a very good safety record, and they have a very good chance in this case of actually providing some therapeutic benefit to the current pandemic.
Ian Jones, Professor of Virology at the University of Reading in the UK, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Plastic bags used to be an environmental nightmare for Kenya. Then 3 years ago, Kenya addressed the problem head-on, banning single-use plastic bags. Now, a fossil fuel industry group wants the U.S. to push Kenya to weaken its plastic restrictions and again bring in mountains of plastic trash from the States. This is happening as the U.S. and Kenya negotiate their first-ever bilateral trade deal. Griffin Zochiang is head of the Center for Environment, Justice, and Development, an NGO in Nairobi that works on the problem of plastic waste. So it's this industry group, the American Chemistry Council, requesting this of the U.S. trade representative. Does that put more pressure on Kenya to do this?
Yes, to go behind and ask the U.S. trade representatives to include this export of plastic waste, it means they are putting a lot of pressure on the Kenyan government to try and ease in this effort that the country has made with regard to plastic.
So if there was a weakening of plastic restrictions in Kenya, how would these changes impact the country?
I would say that they're not just plastic waste. They contain a number of toxic elements in there because they are made from fossil fuel. And Kenya has been a leading country in terms of plastic pollution. You know, the 2017 ban was very protective of single-use plastic. And this is going to bring a lot of plastic waste into the country. As a country, we have challenges in managing already what we have.
Have you spoken with the Kenyan government about your concerns over this attempt to influence Kenyan environmental policy?
Yes, we did this as an organization. We were able to share the information that came from the New York Times with the ministry. We have not officially wrote a letter to the ministry to get their position, and that's the plan that we are intending to do. We've seen a number of news outlets which has quoted even our minister of trade saying that this information has not reached them.
So, Griffins, today, do you know whether the Kenyan government is considering reversing or weakening any of its restrictions on plastic?
From what information that came is that this was a wish list that was made by the American Chemistry Council to the U.S. trade negotiation agreement. It is not clear that the U.S. made official this request that the American Chemistry Council made to the negotiation that they were doing with Kenya.
Is most of the plastic waste that Kenya imports, is it from the United States?
I don't have that information with regard to which country it's coming from. That's something that we are trying to now also trying to assess. What we know is that the U.S. has been exporting its plastic waste for recycling to Asia, including China. And China last year, 2019, put a stop to that import of plastic for waste recycling. And so we see that now the U.S. is making effort to reach out to other regions, looking at Kenya and Africa as potential new areas to export waste for recycling. And that's why there's been a lot of effort to promote recycling in developing countries, including Kenya. But recycling itself is a scheme. There is no value in plastic waste recycling. Actually, to be exact, only 9% is recycled. The rest are just ending up in the dump sites and landfills and in the environment.
What have you noticed as far as improvements go since the single-use plastics ban went into effect 3 years ago?
People have embraced alternative carrier bags. The culture of, you know, littering and throwing, particularly bags when you go shopping, is really changed. We are making effort to control the other single-use water bottles, soda, that are just thrown out. And now you want to open again for an increased number of export of this plastic waste. We can't agree to that. This is not in the interest of the Kenyan public.
Griffin Zochiang heads the Center for Environment, Justice, and Development, an NGO that works on the problem of plastic waste in Kenya and around the globe. He joined us from Nairobi. Griffins, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Literally every day in my city, I hear about another restaurant, another business closing. The pandemic has hit the restaurant industry hard. Small businesses, generally, are struggling the most, especially those run by African Americans and Latinos. The world's Daisy Contreras has been finding out why.
Remember, an empanada is like this. It has to be like a half moon.
Lorena Cantarovici is making empanadas, folding a piece of dough into a half moon shape. There's potato and meat stuffing in the middle. She came from Argentina 20 years ago, and after working in restaurants, she decided to launch her own business making empanadas, something she missed from home. Since the pandemic, she's turned to teaching online too.
That's not an empanada, señorito. Empanada means empanar.
Before the pandemic, Cantarovici's empanada business, Maria Empanada, was thriving. She had 5 restaurants in Denver, Colorado, and the Argentinian news media constantly profiled her success. They call her Argentina's empanada ambassador.
Oh my goodness, when that came in the news, it was kind of like a good feeling.
Now, the pandemic has forced all business owners like Cantarovici to think differently about how they run their business. But those owned by African Americans and Latinos are especially struggling. Marlene Orozco is with the Stanford Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative. They're a group that's tracking Latino-owned businesses. Orozco says over the last decade, Latinos were starting businesses at a higher rate than all other groups in the U.S. Most are in the restaurant industry.
Latino businesses before the pandemic started small and stayed small. And a lot of that had to do with issues of access to capital. And so we're seeing some of these same challenges in terms of facing the pandemic.
And access to that capital is even more challenging since the pandemic. Orozco says access to funding from the government's Paycheck Protection Program is limited.
There was an overall lack of guidance on how to apply for the program.
Cantarovici says she had help filling out the forms, but it took time to figure out the process. Meantime, bigger businesses could rely on hiring lawyers or teams of people to make sure their applications got in quickly. It left small businesses like Cantarovici's waiting for the second round of funding.
Of course, we apply. We were kind of, if it opens today at 10 a.m., we were pressing the submit button at that time. But when the funds depleted, it was devastated. It was devastated for me.
Adding to that devastation is the language barrier, she says. Many small business owners across all demographics are immigrants who may not be fluent in English.
My English is not perfect and it's never going to be in a legal aspect. So for me, it's very important that I protect myself with the right people that I will have next to me. But for very small businesses at the beginning, that is so expensive.
So business owners like Cantarovici rely on their community networks to survive, says Orozco.
One of the things that has been most striking is this sense of community and helping each other out, even when one is facing difficult challenges, right? So there's the Spanish idiom, donde come uno, come dos.
Where one eats, two can eat, she says.
And so we really see that. We really see Latino business owners stretching what they have to reach wide communities. Now, of course, that can only go so far.
The future is uncertain for those owners without more help, Orozco says. Many are running out of the government cash they've received. Latinos in particular don't have safety nets. Lorena Cantarovici doesn't have one. She cut back on staff and temporarily closed 3 of her 5 restaurants. Luckily, her empanadas are still selling.
It's a very elegant pastry that can have a fantastic flavor, has a lot of benefits. It's transportable, it's kid-friendly, it's not messy. You can be walking with an empanada.
But she's worried if sales go down even more. And she's hoping for more government help. She says she's constantly thinking about that. And it'll be on her mind as she votes in November.
This is when we need to vote. We need to have our voice here.
For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
You're listening to The World. Coming up on the show, meet Pepper.
Tell me what kind of situations make you feel happy.
A robot designed to combat loneliness.
We program the robot to greet the person and initiate a conversation about food or music or movies.
Mental health gets a hand from artificial intelligence. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World from PRX and GBH. South African Caster Semenya won the 800-meter run at the Rio Olympics in 2016.
2 meters in front of the top of the lane. Semenya running for gold now in front of Dean Saba and Bishop and Wambui, but she's left the others in her wake. And Caster Semenya is going to do what most people thought she would do in the 800, and she runs away and wins it brilliantly. In second placing, Dean Saba, the bronze.
A ruling handed down yesterday, though, says Caster Semenya won't get to defend her title at next year's Olympics unless she takes medication to lower her testosterone levels. Semenya has a genetic condition that elevates the level of male sex hormones in her body. A new rule instituted in 2018 disqualifies her from competing internationally because of that condition. Semenya has been fighting that rule since it was passed and just lost her second appeal. Gregory Knott is one of her attorneys and joins us from Johannesburg. Thanks very much for being with us, Gregory. You've been at Caster's side through this whole process. What's your reaction to this ruling?
Look, we were very disappointed, naturally, to get the ruling that we have. However, just the past has shown us that 7% of CAS rulings have really been overturned by the Supreme Court. And so the odds were stacked against us. Yes, we were disappointed. Were we completely flabbergasted? No. I mean, at the end of the day, this is the dignity of Custer. And would a judgment like this be found against a male runner? Would it be found against, let's say, a European runner? Would we find ourselves in the same position?
Have you spoken to Custer, and how is she feeling about this?
She's very positive. She spoke, this is her quote, "The doors are closed but not locked." And so she sees opportunity, whether it be legal means, alternatively, track means, athletic means, of still fighting back and of still making her presence felt amongst competitors.
Tell us more about the 2018 rule about testosterone levels that triggered all of this. Why was that rule established in the first place?
Well, very simply put, it was seen as an advantage. So that particular ruling was to negate or try and create a fairness within the complete section of runners under a women's race. And for that reason, a particular level was, as a cutoff, as it were, anyone above that level had to have hormonal or surgical interventions to ensure that their testosterone levels were dropped. Now, one would argue, you know, did Phelps have to have his feet cut off because he had bigger feet when he swam a distance than the other swimmers? She was born as a woman, and she competed as such.
So is that your argument when you initially appealed that rule on behalf of Caster, that she was born this way, she is female, et cetera?
Well, partly, and a large part of the appeal went to the human dignity and human rights of Caster and the effects of these regulations upon her dignity, upon her self-image, and a whole variety of other human rights issues as well.
What are Caster Semenya's options at this point? And is taking this medication to lower her testosterone in order to qualify something she's considering?
Never. She won't do it. Period. That's it. Never. You'll never find her do it. She's absolutely strong-willed, and there's absolutely no ways that she'll take any medicine or hormonal interventions at all physically. She testified as much, and she said as much publicly, so you won't find her do that, no.
So, Gregory, I know you've been representing Caster pro bono. Why is her case important to you? Why do you continue to fight for her?
I see the will of Caster. I see her indomitable spirit. I see her as a person, as a human being, and I think that really strikes a chord. It resonates and I identify with her in so many ways. I see the love of our country for her. I see one thing I really hate are bullies, and I've always hated them since I was a young schoolboy. So I can't stand it, and I don't like the lean on, quite frankly. I've seen the lean on her since I first represented her 10 years ago, and that really roused me up. I was involved in activist law many years ago, decades ago, and it's within my very being. And Custer for me resonates, and she's not only a client but a family friend and part of the family. So for me, I'm very passionate about her. I love the way she holds herself and carries herself. And if you knew South Africa and where she came from, and the fight that she's actually had to do and take, would be an extraordinary story that she has told, and it deserves telling. Because it's such an example for others, and not only others in South Africa, but others who want the opportunity in the rest of the world. You know, if you want to see justice done at the end of the day, and you want to see fair play. So there is a sense of being robbed.
Gregory Knott in Johannesburg. He's one of the attorneys who represents South African Olympian Caster Semenya. Good luck, Gregory. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate all your support. Thank you.
For years in Spain, animal rights activists have battled to end bullfighting. The tradition, as we'll hear in this next story, ends in a violent death for the bull. But with Spain trying to control the spread of coronavirus at mass gatherings, bullfights are canceled and the industry is in existential trouble. So can a tradition that is also deeply controversial survive? Jennifer Omani reports from Madrid.
The brass band warms up the bullring as spectators take their seats, 3 feet apart in Añoverde Dajo, a small town close to Madrid. For many attending, it could be the only bullfight they'll witness this year. In a nearby hotel, Leandro Gutierrez has his own playlist going. Freddie Mercury helps him get into the zone as he's sewn into the skin-tight, intricately decorated outfit of a torero.
No se puede.
It's the 22-year-old Colombian's debut as a junior bullfighter, which would make his coaches nervous any year. But in the time of COVID, his big day nearly didn't happen at all. Bullfighting is at crisis point in Spain. After 3 months of total lockdown ended, the country has still only hosted a handful of the events planned. Some wonder if this is the final blow for bullfighting. A poll in May found that almost half of Spaniards want bullfighting banned, and the number of bullfights is down by a third from a decade ago. In his hotel room, Gutierrez is too nervous to speak as he pictures the 800-pound bull he will face holding just a red rag and a sword. But Mariano Aliaga, the director of the bullfighting school he attends, tells me he's watched his students' progress with admiration during his years there.
In Colombia, there are young men who decide to abandon their family, friends, and their whole world to come to Spain with nothing. It's admirable. In Leandro's case, he left everything behind to achieve his dream.
But Aliaga knows that bullfighting is in trouble. The Spanish state has so far refused to bail out the industry, leaving bullfighters unemployed and bullrings sitting empty during the pandemic. For this aficionado, the end of the toreros would be a tragedy.
In my opinion, Spain would lose one of its hallmarks, one of its brands and part of its identity.
Back at the bullring, it's a family affair. The event begins, and the confused-looking black bull enters the ring. What comes next can be disturbing to watch and hear. First is the warm-up. Men on horseback stab the animal with spears. The bull runs around the ring, exhausted and bleeding, chasing his tormentors. Then, it's Gutierrez's turn. The crowd goes wild as he brings the bull close, very close, with a bright red cape, and is even lightly gored. Finally, the exhausted animal stands in front of him, and Gutierrez draws his sword. He plunges the blade between the bull's shoulders once, twice, three times. The bull starts to bleed from the nose, collapses, and dies. His performance is rewarded with 2 ears cut from the dead bull, an honour. He tells me afterwards it was better than he could ever have hoped.
It was great. It all went just like I had dreamed, so I'm feeling very happy.
But the date of Gutierrez's next bullfight is unknown, and he needs to succeed in 24 more to qualify as a matador, or pro bullfighter.
There won't be many events this year, so I just have to keep training and growing as a bullfighter, if we're allowed to.
Bullfighting is considered an art, not a sport, in Spain. One the industry says is worth $1.8 billion. That's partly due to the value of breeding bulls. Prized toros bravos, the breed used for fighting, can be worth $20,000 each. It costs breeder Antonio Boyano $1,200 a year to raise each of his bulls, but no one is buying them now.
The problem here is that I have zero income, but the bulls still have to eat. I have the same costs, but my income is gone.
He said he can survive a few more months, but others have already given up. At least 6,000 bulls destined for bullfights have been slaughtered already this year. Boyano believes that without intervention, the Toro Bravo breed will die out, as it's not usually used for meat. For those who've campaigned for years to end bullfighting, the virus has become an unexpected ally. Theodora Iona of animal rights group PETA wants a sanctuary to be created for the bulls left in limbo and for Spain to move on.
I really hope that this is the end. We were expecting the end to come sooner or later. It's just people are just more and more aware of it. And there's only so much that you can use the excuse that it's tradition and it's culture. At one point, that will end.
There is now debate as to whether bullfighting should be included in new animal protection regulations in Spain. Bullfighting has been threatened with bans and financial crises many times in the last 300 years. Perhaps a pandemic will achieve what hundreds of protests have not. For The World, Jennifer Omani in Madrid.
Antarctica's Thwaites Glacier has been dubbed the Doomsday Glacier because as it melts, it's likely to trigger significant sea level rise. We took you to the face of the glacier last year when scientists got their first up-close look at it.
We've been telling everybody this is where rapid change is really happening, and we're actually standing and looking at the bit that's rapidly changing.
Now, new research findings from that trip have just been published. They show that valleys on the sea floor thought to be funneling warm water to the glacier are deeper than anyone thought, up to a third of a mile deep. That means lots of warm ocean water is reaching the glacier and melting it. We'll have all the details on that latest research tomorrow here on The World. Musician Vusi Malasela is known simply as The Voice in South Africa. His songs have honored Nelson Mandela and accompanied anti-apartheid activists for years in their struggle. But for his latest album, Vusi Malasela returned home to the township of Mamelodi, where he grew up. Vusi Malasela recorded the album in his hometown. He was raised in Mamelodi by his grandmother, Magogo Ida. The new album is named in her honor. I spoke with Vusi recently via Zoom and asked him about the title, Shebeen Queen.
Shebeen, it's what we will call the speakeasy. So the Shebeen Queen, that was my grandmother. She had the skill of brewing the African beer, Umkomboti. And she started selling beer around the people who were working around Mamelodi and Pretoria.
So making homebrew and selling it in the Shebeen was how your grandmother survived. What are your memories of the Shebeen? You would have been really young. Or even what you were feeling as you peered into these cramped spaces where music and beer kind of changed people's lives for a few hours?
Yeah, very much so, because when I was born and then I was raised there at my grandmother's place. And there used to be quite a lot of characters coming to the Shebeen. Musicians, you know, artists, gangsters, even politicians will come. And political meetings were held at the Shebeen. And it was a place where it sort of championed the social cohesion, because it was people coming from different places. So I'm dedicating this album to my grandmother with the role that you play as a person who really championed the social cohesion and the township economy, but also to celebrate the township music that was played then.
Vusi Malasela's grandma was a survivor. Her husband, Vusi's grandfather, was murdered in 1961, before Vusi was born. As the singer grew up, he saw how the shebeen was a lifeline, not just a source of income for his grandma, but a source of morale for the township. The sounds that sprung from those shebeens was Vusi's first exposure to live music.
So for me to bring this township music, it's just to rubber stamp the accent of our own, you know, music, South African music, that we must pride ourselves of.
There are so many new idioms of music in South Africa and old idioms that are evolving. Are the sounds of the townships in danger of being lost?
That is why I was very much trying to do this Shebeen Queen, you know, album with this music. The music is still here and it's still really great, much alive. But I think it is for us to really take it upon our hands to educate the young ones.
South African musician Vusi Malasela, his new album is Shebeen Queen, remembering his grandma and his hometown of Mamelodi. Whether it's Belarus or bullfighting or musical memories of shebeens, here at The World, we bring you important voices with context and first-hand perspectives on the radio, but also in our newsletter. It's called Top of the World, and our team here sends it out to you weekday mornings. Stay connected with The World and the stories we're chasing. Sign up to Top of the World by heading to theworld.org/newsletters. It's been going on for a month now. In Belarus, protesters pushing for the resignation of longtime President Alexander Lukashenko. For weeks, they've been met with fierce pushback from police, stun grenades, rubber bullets, and arrests. Then last month, Belarusian tech CEO Mikita Mikado offered those police compensation if they refused to follow local orders in dealing with citizen protesters. Now the Minsk office of his software company PandaDoc has been raided. Mikita Mikado joins me. You're based in San Francisco, but many of your coworkers and employees are in Belarus and were in your offices in Minsk during the raid. Can you describe what happened?
What happened is on September 2nd, our office was raided and searched. During the search, more than 20 employees were prevented from leaving the office. Seven of them were taken into custody and detained for further interrogation. And four people remain in custody. These four folks have been in prison for over a week. Over the course of last 7 days, over 170 employees were questioned. So this last week has been a nightmare for us.
And what are the charges?
The case is about stealing money from the government, and that is very strange because we never worked with the government in Belarus, and we know that our employees are accused of taking about $40,000 from the corporate accounts of the company in Minsk, abusing their positions, and thus causing damage to the state. We're just trying to connect the dots, but the dots are not connecting.
Do you believe those charges are trumped up?
Of course.
We should remind everyone that 1 month ago today, President Lukashenko won yet another election that his opposition says he rigged. You made headlines, as I said, for offering financial support to Belarusian law enforcement who would not follow orders to confront protesters. Do you think that's why your offices were raided?
Absolutely. I've offered financial support to those officers, forces members who were prosecuted for not following unlawful orders. Particularly orders to beat people up, torture, and rape. Those are some of the things that happened in Belarus. As a Belarusian, I just couldn't sit still and watch this happening in my country, in my homeland.
Do you know people personally who've been caught up in some of this crackdown in the last month?
Yeah. I've heard firsthand from people that I know how they were beaten up and how they were brought to the prisons, how they spend days in the cells that are made for five people that contained 30-something people. The stories are horrifying. And that's why I did what I did, because it's inhumane. It's like you can't comprehend something like that happening in the middle of Europe in 21st century. Like you can't watch a video where five people are beating someone to death and be like, oh yeah, that's great. If you're a normal human being, if you're sane, that's just not going to happen. You're gonna get mad because those scenes are like, it really happened. It happened to most likely a friend of your friend, maybe your friend.
Mikita, do you want to return to Belarus?
I'd love to.
And is the return kind of dependent on whether Lukashenko stays in power?
Yeah, I don't think I can return and remain free until, you know, the current government is in power.
Mikita, at times during our interview, you sounded like you were choosing your words carefully. Are you worried about speaking publicly right now?
I am worried for the safety of my teammates, the ones that are being in custody.
Mikita Mikado is the CEO of PandaDoc, a software company whose Minsk offices were raided by police last week. Mikita has been speaking with us from San Francisco. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Loneliness is a big problem during the pandemic, especially when you're older. It's actually a crisis and calls for creative thinking and, as we're about to hear, even some unusual solutions.
Tell me what kind of situations make you feel happy.
I love children. I like lovely music.
That's one solution, Pepper. Pepper is a robot. A study that deployed Pepper in elder care homes in the UK and Japan found that it helped reduce loneliness and improve mental health. Chris Papadopoulos is a public health lecturer at the University of Bedfordshire in England and lead author of the study. Chris, how did your study work and what did you learn after looking at these people who interacted with Pepper?
We gave 33 older adults residing in long-term care settings across England and Japan about 2 weeks worth of time with our particular version of the Pepper robot. And when I say particular version, what I'm saying is that we developed very particular groundbreaking version of its software, in particular developing a culturally competent artificially intelligent system that's capable of having ongoing meaningful conversations. That was really the key aspect. And talking is good for health, as we found in our results.
So what kinds of interactions could someone have with Pepper? Like, how is it possible for people in these elder care homes to have like a conversation?
We program the robot to greet the person and initiate a conversation about food or music or movies or, you know, sports or whatever else. The same sort of thing that we would do in real life if we wanted to just generate some chit-chat and get somebody talking and feeling good. The robot does have a tablet on its chest. So, for example, if the person said, oh, yeah, I really like Bollywood movies, it would load up a movie and you know, and the person could watch or play music or connect them to their friends and family or send messages, you know, the usual things that you can usually do on a tablet.
So I'm wondering if there are specific conditions, I'm thinking Alzheimer's, that maybe Pepper is especially suited for.
I believe that Pepper would be good for preventing the onset of dementia and Alzheimer's and so forth, because, of course, talking, as I said earlier, is really good for cognitive health, getting the brain thinking and accessing memories perhaps they haven't in a while through music and through conversations about their history and so forth. That's well evidenced to really prevent and slow down the onset of dementia.
In the future, in elder care settings, how could you see robots like Pepper being used? What role could they play?
What we mustn't do is push this out in a hope that we are taking away real human jobs. It really is not about that at all. It's about using these robots in a complementary, supplementary way so that, you know, when there are times when older adults are by themselves and staff just simply aren't around because they can't be around all the time, then there's an option for these people to be talking to these robots and so forth.
Chris Papadopoulos is a public health researcher at the University of Bedfordshire in England. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
That takes care of business for us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. When we're not on the radio, you can find us online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.